Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording from our 2024 Passover Learning Series with Rabbi Cantor Hilary Chorney.
I don't know if this is as popular as just the general series is or how many people are particularly excited to learn about Impossible Meat. This is a journey that I have been on, not the vegetarianism, but the part where I research what vegetarian items might possibly be kosher for Passover. That started about 3.5 years ago. So the first time that I offered Pesach, a halachic ruling, a Jewish legal ruling for Passover, was in 2021. That was the first year that I'd finished research in time to publish that opinion. And to this day, with all the cool things I think I've been doing out there in the Jewish world, the number one thing, like the most emails I get all year round, are people writing to me to ask me questions or comment on the ruling that I made about Impossible Meat. And I think that says something about the way that Jews are trying to eat nowadays. I think it says something to the widespread nature of less meat eating. I'm not even going to call it vegetarianism because there's so much in between eating no meat and eating meat broadly. And, you know, giving people options to have more dairy. Frankly, I'm not a vegan. I'm a vegetarian. I'm a sucker for some good cheese. So I love that. So I will spoil, Renee, the ruling is yes, you can eat Impossible Meat on Passover. I'm going to spoil that from the start. We're going to actually start from the fact that I believe that it's kosher for Passover and that I did the work this year to go back and find out if indeed I was loath to look into it. I didn't want to find out what I didn't want to find out, but indeed it is still kosher as of the current production process. So let's get into it. Is everybody a little bit curious at least about like how it could be, what Impossible Meat is, how that all works out? Yeah, or a little bit maybe curious on the front. Okay, great. So I'm going to use some slides, but I won't use slides the whole time probably. I will show you right now. We'll get started. Anything that you come to learn about, I'm curious about. Okay, hang on. Where's my share screen? There we go. Okay, so we're going to take a look first at the ruling. I'm going to make it nice and big, and I'm going to read through it. And then what we're going to do is learn about it for a good 30 minutes, maybe more. And then we're going to come back to the ruling. So if there are phrases you don't yet understand, what I'd like for you to do is to put words or phrases into the chat as I read through this that are that pose questions for you that you're not 100% sure you understand the definition of. Chances are you are not the only one. So the question, because this is a ruling that's in the form of a question and answer, the question is Impossible Meat kosher for Passover? Impossible Meat is a brand, and in particular, I'm referring to what their product Impossible Meat is, which is the ground beef of a variety with no other appendages to that title. So there's Impossible Chicken Nuggets, there's Impossible Meat Light, all that. I'm referring to the packages of ground beef-esque vegetarian protein. And here's the answer. And we'll start from the answer, come back to the answer. Impossible Meat is certified pariv by the Orthodox Union, the OU, for consumption for general kashrut purposes. There is no ingredient in Impossible Meat that constitutes chametz. The two ingredients that might be of concern, maltodextrin and yeast extract, were confirmed by the company itself not to be derived from cereal grains. Still, those ingredients comprise less than 2% of the product and are nullified 1/60, as in nullified when there's only one part per 60th, if the product is purchased before Passover, Pesach, begins. There are two major kitniot ingredients in the product, soy protein concentrate and soy protein isolate. The latter is listed by several major kosher organizations as a confirmed kitniot product. That's soy protein isolate. It comprises less than 2% of the product and therefore is nullified by the majority of the product being non-kitniot in nature. The second ingredient in the product, after water, is soy protein concentrate. Pause there for a second to just say, As you may or may not be aware, the way that the FDA works when it comes to food labeling is that ingredients are listed by the amount, by the quantity of ingredient in descending order. So water is the most present ingredient, and the second most present ingredient is something called soy protein concentrate. That product is a highly processed extract of soy flour intended for to concentrate the protein content and remove the soybean flavor. Given the specifics about this majority of the product consisting of a kidney oat derivative that does not resemble of grain and cannot be confused with chametz, we should not be concerned about the consumption of this product in any amount. To be cautious, we might recommend that the product only be consumed if purchased before Pesach, such that any chametz might exist in trace content be nullified, though the product is certified gluten-free and the company itself has confirmed no grain content is used. So the ruling is that Impossible Meat, I hold that it is permissible even to those who are low ochle kidney-yot, that is, you come from a family, a custom, or you individually do not consume products that fall under the umbrella of kidney-yot. All right, let's get some comments in the chat. Nullification when on purpose versus by accident. I'll spoil that for you, Tybalt, and say nullification even when you know it's happening, even on Pesach. Okay, so nullification when it comes to kidney oat is easy. You can it's batel barov. It is nullified even if it's just one bit less than the majority of a product, and it can even happen on Passover. Okay, so what phrases do you not yet understand? We're going to break this down, and by the end of this, what I want is for this not to be Greek to anyone. I want everyone to understand this. Renee, what's up?
I'm still confused. So if we don't eat kidney oat
Correct.
at all, so we won't eat, sadly to my husband, any Israeli tchina, that kind of stuff, hummus, he has to fast from that for a week. Then I'm not clear on how this would be okay for us to eat.
So that is because, Renee, we're going to get into this in detail. Kidney oat derivatives, meaning even if you don't eat soy oil, or kidney oat derivatives, things that come from kidney oat are not forbidden. It's already a fence around a fence. It's considered a great chumrah, a great stricture that we wouldn't consume stuff that maybe kind of seems like it might be chametz. That's the category of kidney oat, things like soy and corn and rice and that delicious Israeli tahina and all the other stuff like that. So on one way that you might already say it's permissible, just looking at the face of things, is that the only products that are kidney oat-esque are already kidney oat derivatives. And the other thing is that when you think that something might be a kidney oat derivative, like, or rather when something is a kidney oat product itself, like the soy protein isolate, it comprises less than 2% of the product, and any kidney oat that's a part of a larger product is nullified, meaning we don't consider the thing kidney oat if it's less than the majority of the product.
So
Okay.
does it apply also to like Morningstar's the burger, the ground meat?
Every single one of the fake meat substitute products requires their own ruling. And so let me start there to say, I don't know. I'm not extending this to any other products. I will start by saying, as far as I can tell, the pea protein that is at the base of Beyond Meat is not nullifiable. And at the very least, I couldn't permit people who are ochle kidney oat to eat, who are low ochle kidney oat to eat. In other words, if you don't eat kidney oat, it would be very hard for me to make a similar ruling because of the protein base that's used in Beyond Meat. So
And
every
OU would also hold by this ruling that you said?
Absolutely not. No, definitely not. So I'm going to explain why they would not hold by consumption. So let's back up a few steps. So the Orthodox Union is in the, let's explain something with the Orthodox Union. And while I'm talking, go ahead and put in the chat anything else you don't understand in here, whether it's kidney oat, maltodextrin, nullified, chametz, any of those phrases. If they're unfamiliar to me, let me know. Otherwise, I'll have to maybe assume that most of you get it, but don't be shy. The shy one doesn't learn. So the Orthodox Union is in the business of putting their hechsher, their stamp of kosher approval. They're in the business of putting that stamp on products that they supervise. I'm going to reframe that same sentence. The OU, the Orthodox Union, they have people who are inspectors, and those inspectors are present for inspection processes, and they lean as far as possible towards Humra, towards being as strict as possible, in order to make sure that everyone but everyone but everyone who might want to hold by them can hold by them, can hold according to, says, feels comfortable with the OU stamp on their food. This means, I will give you an example of one way in which the OU is pretty obviously not a not following the literal letter of the law, but rather being even more strict than necessary. There are dairy products that are used on the same equipment as Oreo cookies. You with me so far? I hate to burst any bubbles for anyone. There is no dairy anywhere in any Oreo cookies, okay? Zero whatsoever. However, according to the Orthodox Union and the way that they supervise the equipment in those in the factory, the label on an Oreo package says OU, Orthodox Union, dairy. Is there any dairy in the Oreo cookie? Still no. But because it's made on the same equipment as other dairy products, instead of writing something that they could write, and by the way, in recent history did write, which is OU dairy equipment. Anybody remember the historical markings that would say DE? There are still a few stamps out there that will do that. What that means, without getting too far afield from our main conversation here, is that dairy equipment foods, they can't be eaten in the same bite as meat. However, they could be eaten, for example, as dessert after meat. By ingredients, and even by the standards that the OU would hold by the book, you can absolutely have a yummy brisket dinner that Renee Bainball's family was eating and have an Oreo cookie for dessert. It is not dairy. No one out there thinks that there's dairy in it. They're not imagining dairy, but their marking of that package to be cautious upon cautious upon cautious is it's dairy because it shares equipment with other dairy items. So I think that that's the clearest example. I'm like, who doesn't know an Oreo cookie? Hopefully that was a clear example to explain that the OU, the way that they certify things, and they are not the only certifying body out there, they would not come and say, for several reasons that we're going to discuss today, they're not going to put an OU kosher for Passover on their package. However, they would, if you were to speak with an OU rabbi and speak to them about ingredients, you could have a much more robust conversation than simply there's a stamp on it or there's no stamp on it. So did I answer the question clearly as to why something can be kosher, but why the OU stamp might still not be on it? I get there? I'm going to assume yes, unless someone interrupts me. Okay, great. I'm going to look at the chat here and see what we've got so far, and then I'll unshare the screen and share some more. So, all right. Customer hall that someone eat dairy and fish at the same meal. It is too far afield, Tybal, for this one. We'll put it in the parking lot, but there are some customs that are recorded even in the Talmud of people not eating dairy with fish. It is strictly custom. Okay, so I'm gonna, because nobody piped up and said, oh, I don't understand what this phrase is or what that is, I'm gonna assume a basic few phrases and take us through a few parts of this. Let me back up one more step beyond that, beyond impossible that. Okay, impossible meat. Impossible meat has been around since approximately 2018, at least to like regular consumers on the street. It was first tested in industrial kitchens. And you might come across their packaging. They have two different packages I want to show you. They've got a few different ways that their packages show up in stores, and they have a new rebrand. So it's important to point that out. Most people are familiar with this particular picture. Give it a second. Oh, it even changed on this. That's so funny. I clicked on it. This is the new branding. It's very red. It's not a new product, but they'll show it here. See, if this was the old one, this is what the old Impossible product and packaging looks like. And here is the new packaging. Same product. We all on the same page? We know what we're talking about. These are sometimes sold in the alternative proteins aisle, they're sometimes sold in the meat section. Often they're sold frozen. They can be sold refrigerated. This is important because I am going to come to the point in the ruling where I say, hey, you might want to buy this before Passover. You can do that because it is often sold frozen and certainly can be frozen. Don't refreeze it, but you can freeze it. Okay, and we're going to take a look closely here at some ingredients. It's not a very clear one. Okay. All right. So in their ingredients list, every time I click on it, I go somewhere else. Well, I guess I should have taken the picture ahead of the class. Sorry. Their ingredients list is water, soy protein concentrate, coconut oil, sunflower oil, natural flavors, 2% or less of, potato protein, methyl cellulose, yeast extract, cultured dextrose, food starch modified, soy leg hemoglobin, which is like the meat that's like the heme, that's the fake heme that makes up a meaty flavor in meat, salt, soy protein isolate, that's that Kitneo product I was talking about. There's vitamin E, zinc gluconate, thiamine, which is another vitamin C, niacin. These are all preservatives at this point, pyridoxine, hydrochloride, that's a vitamin B6, vitamin B2, and vitamin B12. Obviously, it contains soy. Okay, and it is marked OU-PAREV. Everybody see that? The OU-PAREV. The Orthodox Union says year-round, it is considered neither meat nor dairy. It is impossible meat. Hey, do you have a question? You guys can also unmute yourselves if you want to. It's okay to interrupt me. And there are lots of brands that sell different types of meat. There's Beyond Meat, there's Morningstar Farms, there are all those. Those each require their own ruling because they each use a different type of protein and a different set of ingredients. I've only researched Impossible. I started there because it was at the time in 2021 the most available meat that I could see any path to, the most available meat alternative that I could see any viable path to ruling was kosher for Passover. Sharon, I saw your hand.
Yeah, I was just wondering for Passover, can we buy it? It doesn't have the little, symbol on it for Pesach.
That's the whole point of this class. That's the whole point of this session tonight is to teach you that there are some things that you do and don't need to have a Hexshulchan or not. And I'm so glad you asked that question because that's exactly where we're going to go next in the explanation. So
Okay.
I want to show you.
But Rabbi, what about the machinery that it's made on?
The machinery that it's made on, this is why, if you're concerned, we'll get there in a minute, but if you're concerned about the machinery that it's made on, the same thing that I would tell you about milk. You can buy 6 gallons of milk before Passover and drink that milk all Passover. It does not need to have been made on a machine that is certified grain-free. There are certain things that you don't, that you can buy before Passover without a heksher. This, I would say my most stringent ruling would be you can do this before. Marcy, I'm glad you brought up the yeast extract. I'm going to explain exactly that, and I'm going to show you the correspondence I had with the Impossible Meat Factory about it. So what I want to do is I want to make sure that we understand the basic phrases of what chametz mean and what also what kitniot is for the purpose of for the purpose of this discussion. Give me a second, I'm going to share also this screen. Okay, there we go. So I want us to take a look at the Conservative Movement's guide, published, republished every year, published this is from this year's published guide. I will put the link in the chat at the end of our time tonight. These are foods that are prohibited during Passover. They are called chametz. We do not eat foods that are chametz traditionally during Passover. We even rid them from our home. Many common foods also contain chametz. Sometimes there is an admixture of chametz, like there's some chametz as a part of a product. Sometimes chametz is the product and the product is chametz, such as biscuits and cakes and crackers and bread. We'll call that obvious. Chametz ba'ayin. You look with your eye and you know that's chametz. Do we ever say that that's kosher for Passover? No, there are no circumstances under which we say that that's kosher for Passover. None of these. some products
But
there,
there is kosher Le Pesach pasta. It's gross.
which is going to only confuse our the point of the class for tonight, because we're talking about pasta here. So Renee, in answer to that, these are foods that are made with the following five grains. The same five grains that make up chametz are the same five grains that you can use to make kosher matzah for Passover. Got it? And those are, I'm going to give it to you in this order: barley, rye, oats, wheat, and spelt. The reason I give it in that order is because I find it easy to remember brows, like eyebrows, as an acronym for all five of those. So those are the same five grains that make up chametz, and also you can make kosher matzah with those grains. That's why that stuff that's like the low carb potato starch based matzah that can't be used for the Seder is not matzah, because it's not made from one of these five grains. Any food containing these grains or derivatives of these grains have to be certified kosher for Passover. I want to make it clear, our homes are not free from wheat, barley, oats, spelt, or rye on Passover. They're actually full of them, but they can be only used where they've come into contact with water for less time than would turn them into chametz. Chametz is when one of these grains is in contact with water for too long and it becomes chametz. Something being chametz is not the same thing as being kosher for Passover or not kosher for Passover, and it's not the same thing even as a third category, which is certified kosher for Passover. I'm going to show you what I mean by that. There are permitted foods. I'm going to read out loud what Rabbi Aaron Alexander has written here. An item that's kosher all year round, that is made with no chametz, meaning none of those five grains touching water for the wrong amount of time, and is processed on machines used only for that item and nothing else, may be used with no special Pesach supervision. Put a pin in that, Renee, because the only thing that the equipment for impossible meat is used for is impossible meat. So let's go back to this. As we learn more about the processing of foods and the ingredients they contain, relying on the kashrut of a product for Pesach without a heksher may be problematic. Wherever possible, processed foods ought to have kasher lePesach heksher, a mark from a reliable source. Since that is not always possible, however, our guidelines reflect some alternatives that are acceptable according to halakha, Jewish law. These following foods do not require any heksher whatsoever to have them in your home and use them on Passover. I will put a giant asterisk on this and say, ideally, and perhaps only, they should be unopened and not having been used for the rest of the year or season. But you can just buy them whenever. Got it? Like, even during Passover, you can go to the store and you can buy baking soda, soda bicarbonate, eggs, fresh fruits and vegetables, fresh or frozen kosher meat, nest tea, pure tea leaves of these varieties, unflavored tea bags, unflavored regular coffee, olive oil, whole or gutted fresh fish, whole or half pecans, whole unground spices or nuts, the OU or Star K raisins, meaning the ones that do not have a heksher that say for Passover, but do have a heksher for all year round. Any kind of kosher wine whatsoever. It need not have the special kosher for Passover thing on it, though most do at this stage. Most factories have gone to the extent that they're also supervised so that they can be certified on their label as kosher for Passover. Unflavored seltzer water. I'm actually curious what got deleted in this bullet point, because I didn't delete it. So what food used to be but isn't anymore? And non-iodized salt. Does everyone understand what this category means? These are foods that are not chametz, do not contain chametz, are not processed with chametz, and all of them can be purchased even during Passover, fresh and used and considered kosher for Passover. Good? We got that so far? That's our first easiest category. We know the stuff we absolutely are not permitting in our home, like crackers and muffins and bread that are made with those five ingredients as exposed to water. Then we have this category of foods, which is you can have any of them. You can buy whatever apples you want, not just for your charoset. You can munch on them all season long. There is a next category, and this is the category in which I would file impossible meat. This is there is no Pesach heksher required if you purchase it before Pesach, and I'm going to explain why. Products which may only be purchased without a Pesach heksher before Passover, if you buy them during Passover, they require a heksher. Pure fruit juices, filleted fish, plain cheeses, like a platter of hectored cheeses from Costco. Frozen fruit that has nothing else added to it. They do not need to have a kosher for Passover supervised stamp on them if you go ahead and buy them before Passover. Add milk to that list. This is the extended list of this. Okay, this includes, and then I see your hand tie, but 1 second. Salt, plain butter, white sugar, date sugar, quinoa, white milk, frozen vegetables, on and on and on. All of these things you may purchase before Passover and use them during Passover with no concern whatsoever. Tybel, do you have a thought on this?
No, actually, two related questions.
Okay, great.
His name wasn't on it, but you said Rabbi Aaron Alexander, who you know is in my region, and he tends to be very lenient.
Yes.
That list, is that a difference between conservative and really, really from Orthodox?
This.
Or some of it that's storekeepers, because if you're a storekeeper, the way you want to market things, you may want to buy things that say kosher LePesach when you don't need it. Or is that a conservative Orthodox difference, that list before this?
So I want to clarify two things. Thanks for asking about that. One is that Rabbi Aaron Alexander does publish his own opinions when it comes to Passover food. He happens to organize this guide for the entire rabbinical assembly, and this guide is passed under the guidance of a very mixed panel of rabbis who sit on the conservative Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. So this is not Rabbi Alexander's rulings, although he does oversee the list gathering process. He instead gathers all those opinions, and it must pass the muster of all the different types of rabbis on that board. It is true and is the case that for those who do not observe according to conservative supervision, or do not go to conservative authorities, but rather Orthodox authorities, or perhaps even Sephardic authorities specific to neither conservative nor Orthodox, not based on a movement, but rather on the cultural background and the regional background of the rabbi by whom they're holding, they will not have this same list. This list is generally held as all of the collective opinions. It's generally relied upon by those who would rely on the supervision of a conservative rabbi. However, many, many, many of these things are agreed upon by the Orthodox movement. But I'm not an Orthodox rabbi teaching the class. I'm a conservative rabbi. Did that answer the question, Tybel?
Yes, it answered the first, but I have a second, which I'm finding this confusing.
Okay.
To me, before Pesach, there's no reason to clean the machinery to get the stuff out of the kitchen. So how could something not need kosher LePesach before, but then you have to be more stringent during, after they've already cleaned the equipment? It makes no sense to me.
I'm so glad that you asked that. And that is because certain ingredients cannot be nullified at all. Tybalt, there's nothing I can do to nullify like the crumbs of crackers during Passover itself. However, before Passover, if you are purchasing a product, stuff is nullified 1 in 60. So if it's only 1/60th or less than a product, those things that are on that list that say it's required that you purchase them before Passover, it's because they can be nullified. And Tybel, I am so glad you said it the way that you said it, because what I want to tell you is people tend to shy away from cooking in their kitchen before Passover because they think that the only way to cook kosher for Passover is to wait until they've cleaned everything and only then will things be kosher for Passover. It's true, the most stringent way to do this is to clean your kitchen for Passover, prepare everything on Pesach dishes, and then you're good to go. You know that during Passover, those things can be relied upon. But it's actually a lot easier to do your cooking and preparation before Passover when you can nullify even those little trace elements of things, one in 60. The stuff that is prepared before Passover, you can actually eat. It is counterintuitive to probably hundreds of years of the tradition of cooking everything before Passover on Passover equipment, but perhaps some of you either personally or come from families where this is the custom, where people just cooked on whatever equipment. And that was not because they were so lenient about being Pesedic. It's because the equipment on which you're cooking before Passover is falling under the guidelines of you can nullify even those like what would be tidbits of chametz, the things that are not where it's not the majority chametz, you can nullify them before it's Passover.
You mean like we can cook on the stove? We can cook non-Pesedic stuff on the stove before Passover when we've already started preparing for Passover?
With Pesedic ingredients, yes, or with the Pesedic stuff that you're preparing. Some people think that feels icky. It doesn't feel right to them. Those people are very, very blessed, and I mean this with no judgment on people in our, it's actually a praise of where we've gotten to in the Jewish community, that affluence permits us to have that other set of dishes and not to have to turn over our whole, this is presuming you could have a whole other set of dishes and didn't have to just kosher everything and start a week early on your one set of dishes, right? We're talking about trying to make Jewish life livable for people who may or may not be able to have this whole extensive second kitchen or second closet of stuff and that sort of a thing. So absolutely, you can go ahead and you can cook those things. Now, of course, I mean, most of my grandparents were like pretty lenient, but there were some people in my grandparents' generation who would look at me and say, "Fuh, like, what do you mean? You can't do that. You got to like first you turn over the kitchen. This is what we do. We turn over the kitchen. We do this. What? Great. Then that's what you do in your home, and that's fine. But you should know that, for example, you are permitted to eat food that someone prepped in their regular old kitchen 3 days before Passover, as long as it falls under those categories that we were just looking at. It's not chametz, it's not muffins or bread, right? And it was less than 1/60th of the product itself. So you can't go ahead and eat the chametz, but if it was cooked on the regular equipment, you certainly can. Tybalt, I'm going to give you one last shout out, and then I want to take us into the
Okay, I'm an old person
Yeah.
and I grew up conservative, affiliated in the Midwest.
Yep.
I can just see my parents, whatever. Is this something the conservative movement has recently found in halacha and articulated, or is it just something that no one paid attention to for decades?
I think that it actually, I think it's neither. First of all, it's not new. Second of all, this is the part of halakha that we share fully with the whole world of halakhically observant Jews. And I think it's the case that actually the stringencies that seem like they've been in place for hundreds of years were not. I can tell you that my dirt poor Jewish family living in Petersburg, Virginia, outside of Richmond, when my grandfather was born in 1915, he moved from New York immediately down there. There's no way on earth they had like the means to turn over their kitchen and do other things. Like even 100 years ago, there's a lot that falls into the category of it seems like we've been this strict for a really long time, but it's not, but it's it has not been. It's actually relatively new. Bacha, I'm going to answer the question that you sent to me in just a moment, but I want to get into the impossible meat. I want to get back into the impossible meat definition, and I want to show you something. So there is the idea of something being nullified one in 60 is a broader law of kashrut that if you accidentally have if you accidentally have that amount of non-kosher food or that amount of dairy and meat or that amount of meat and dairy that you can nullify it, generally speaking. And that has nothing to do with Passover itself. There are different rules depending on whether we're talking about chametz or whether we are talking about kitniot. So before Passover begins, like if you're cooking something that's before the actual days of Pesach begins, batal b'shishim applies. You can nullify 1/60th of what might be chametz stick in that. That is what permits people to cook ahead of time. But that is a cousin of the other rule about being able to nullify, generally speaking, a little bit of dairy and a drop of dairy and meat, a drop of meat and dairy. Kitniot, for those who observe the rules of not eating corn, rice, beans, that sort of a thing, that is always batal barov, even during Pesach. It is always nullified as long as it's less than 50% of the product. Okay, less than 50% of the product, and it's always nullified even throughout. So now let's go and look back and pick apart my ruling again. And we're going to, I'm going to get you to yes, yes, yes. I'm going to get you to everybody understanding the full ruling, and I'm going to show you the conversation to get back to, somebody asked me about that yeast extract. That's where we're going in just a minute. Okay, so actually, no, let's not share this one. I'm going to share it a different way. One second. Okay, now we're going to walk back through this a little bit. Impossible meat is certified, neither dairy nor meat, by the Orthodox Union for consumption for general kashrut purposes. So year round, they send people into the factory and they say, this is a kosher product for people to consume. It can be eaten with dairy products, with meat products, or with neither, because look, a lot of vegans like Impossible Meat, right? It's a vegan product. There is no ingredient in Impossible Meat that constitutes chametz on the list of ingredients that exist. I'm going to show you right now what that list of ingredients is. I'm going to put it in the chat so you can look at it at the same time as this thing on the screen. There is no ingredient in Impossible Meat that could possibly be construed as actual chametz. The two ingredients that you might look at on the list and say, whoopsie daisy, that looks like it might be chametz, meaning an admixture of one of those five grains, the browse grains and water, are maltodextrin and yeast extract. Both of those products can be derivatives of cereal grains, but they were confirmed by the company itself not to be derived from cereal grains. Are you ready for the cool, like, proprietary peek? I've never shown anyone else this before besides the rabbis at the CGLS when I showed this tshuva. This is emet, which is very funny because that means truth in Hebrew, and emes in Yiddish means truth. And somebody named Emmett from Impossible Foods wrote the following. Hello there. Thanks for your patience as we connected with our health and nutrition team. A few of the ingredients in our products are made using processes that involve corn, though not the yeast extract or food starch. Pause on that for a second. Is corn chametz ever?
Yes. No, it's kitniot.
It's only, so we wouldn't even be concerned about it, but they're worried because I asked this as a question about allergies. Okay. So they're worried about like allergen grain. And when we say grains and you're not talking to a Jew, right? Like we say Jewish day. When does the Jewish day start? At night, right? We're saying grains to the broader world. We're not saying grains. Jewish grains are barley, rye, oats, wheat, spelt, right? But this is grains and they're thinking about corn as well. He says not the yeast extract or food starch aren't even corn derivatives. They're derived from non-grain products. The risk of corn protein residues being present in the final product is extremely low. There are no ingredients derived from any other cereal grains in our products. Got it? There is no ingredient anywhere in the products, plural, that are derived from cereal grains. Our products are certified gluten-free and do not share lines with any gluten-containing products. That said, we always recommend that consumers with food allergies or sensitivities to certain ingredients speak directly with the restaurant they're dining at to find out what toppings and condiments they are serving with our products and what cross-contamination risks may be present. Call me if you have questions. Okay.
Do we understand? That corn part, is that considered kitniot then? Would that make the Impossible
but
food?
Even people who consider kitniot to be impermissible for consumption during Passover have two things to rely upon here. One, these are, if at all, it sounds like they're not, but even if they were derived from corn, that's still a kitniot derivative and not kitniot itself. And there are no authorities that say that you must, besides maybe like my grandma. Like there are no rabbinic authorities who say that there's halachic precedent, that there's legal precedent for which you must not consume derivatives of kitniot. You're already being more strict by not eating kitniot. That's a derivative. Second thing though, Renee, even if you said, I don't want to eat anything that touched any corn, period, whatever, in during, even during Passover, before Passover, during Passover, anytime, that kitniot is considered nullified as long as it is not the majority ingredient in the product. And this is far less than the majority ingredient in the product. Did I explain that well?
Yeah.
It can't possibly, there's not enough corn, and it's not even corn. So, and there's no other cereal grain whatsoever that is present. And this is based on a question about allergens, as you can tell by the way that the answer is framed. So even these two ingredients that might be of concern, maltodextrin and yeast extract, were confirmed by the company itself not to be derived from cereal grains. Still, those ingredients, this is rephrasing what I just said to you, Renee, comprise less than 2% of the product and are nullified 1 in 60 if the product is purchased before Pesach begins. It's even true that they're nullified in the majority if they're kitniot. But if you were concerned whatsoever, I'm going back to my reasoning, if you were concerned whatsoever that the maltodextrin or yeast extract might ever have been part of the chametz family, as long as you purchase Impossible Meat before Pesach, those little ingredients are nullified. It is not the majority of the product. Hang on, I see something in the chat. Oh my gosh, my pleasure, Bobby.
Can I ask you another question then? If you, what you were talking about in terms of the percentage of kitniot that would be considered kitniot, if Effie decided to eat, I don't know, a minuscule amount of tchina on matzah that was kosher for Pesach, then would that not be considered kitniot?
No, that's kitniot. What wouldn't be kitniot is if he had an entire, if he had one drop of tahina to 60 drops of vinegar in a salad dressing, or rather, I'm sorry, we're talking about kitniot. As long as it's less than half of the salad dressing, if he mixes his own salad dressing, right, as long as it's less than half of, it's not even kitniot. Every custom that people have or when it comes to kitniot is just that, it's a custom, staying away from it. But the people who take it strictly kehalacha, like it's a custom that's almost halacha in their family, it's almost law in their family, for them, as long as it's less than 50% of a product, it's not the majority of the product. I'll tell you one other thing though.
That's what I mean. If he ate it on a whole piece, if he ate a tablespoon of tchina on a whole piece of matzah, is that considered okay, even if we hold by kitniot?
Only the batel, the nullified, is when the final product itself is in and of itself a final product from which you cannot tell what those things are a part of. A soup, a stew, a dressing. That's why I went to dressing. Glad you asked the question the way that you did. It's not just like, well, I'm going to put a little drop of peanut butter on a giant matzah. Peanut butter also, not kidding out even. I'm glad you asked it that way though. So now we know that even if these ingredients might have some doubt in our mind that these ingredients were chametz, as long as we buy them before Passover, it is a confirmed fact, not only by the people who work at Impossible Foods, but also the FDA, that less than 2% of the product is made up of these ingredients. And therefore, if it's purchased before Pesach, the strictest opinion, I would say, is that in purchasing it pre-Pesach, you know that those things are nullified. There are two major kitniot related ingredients. I should really say kitniot related, not just even kitniot ingredients, but I'm trying to be as strict as possible. People want to be careful even about kitniot. Soy protein concentrate and soy protein isolate. Let's take the second one first, like I did here. It's listed by major kosher organizations, this ingredient, soy protein isolate. You need to know a lot of science to understand what that is, how it is produced, how it's washed, how it's taken from being soy, turned into something else. Their concern, I'm going to make it brief, is basically that we cannot confirm when it comes to soy protein isolate, what kind of alcohol. There are three different processes by which soy protein isolate can be produced. And alcohol may have been used in washing that product or taking it from what it was to this new product of soy protein isolate. And because it might be a grain-based alcohol and we're not sure what it might be, or even a corn alcohol, so we're not sure if it could be a kitniot-related thing, they say it's kitniot. I think that that's like strict beyond strict, but that's fine. They say it's too close to being soy in and of itself. And therefore, between it being too close to soy in and of itself and also might be washed with some sort of an alcohol, it's considered a major kitniot ingredient. Soy protein, and it comprises less than 2% of the product, and therefore it's nullified because the majority of the product is not soy protein isolate. It's an itty bitty part of what the product is. The soy protein concentrate is a highly processed extract of soy flour intended for concentrating the protein content. Well, I really got to fix the grammar on this. For concentrate of the protein content and remove the soybean flavor. So the notion there is that you're completely taking the soy itself and you are turning it into flour, turning that flour into something else, and deliberately eliminating the soybeaniness out of it. They actually refer to it on the website as a fishy flavor, which has forever ruined how I taste soybeans and like edamame, because I don't think of it as fishy, but now that they've said it's fishy, I can't like unknow that, unthink that. But they say the whole point of the soy protein isolate is for it to be what we would call a devar acher. It is a completely different type of an ingredient. It is no longer even recognizably kidney oat, let alone chametz. But even if it was, it's less than 2% of the product, and therefore it is nullified in the majority of the product if we thought that maybe possibly that kidney oat was an issue. Oh, sorry, let me back up a step. That's not true for the soy protein concentrate. The soy protein concentrate, the reason that it is permissible even for those people who don't eat kidney oat is because it is unrecognizably soy. It is a brand new product. It's something else. This is the part where if you do eat kidney oat freely, then you can say, well, it's fine for me because I eat kidney oat. And so it's whatever. But if you do have concern about kidney oat, you would say the soy protein isolate is less than 2% of the product. And soy protein concentrate, even though it has the word soy in it, it's been so changed from what it originally was, we no longer even worry about it being a type of kidney oat. Let's see. Oh, okay. And yes, I am delighted. And given the specifics about this, the majority of this product consisting of a kidney oat derivative that does not resemble a grain, it can't be confused with chametz. I've never confused that fake beef. It might be confused for beef, but it wouldn't confuse it for chametz. We shouldn't be concerned about the consumption of the product in any amount. We don't have to say, well, you can only use a little bit of this because then that the product in and of itself would be nullified, right? Imagine if we said, well, it's kidney oat. Well, you know it's kidney oat. If we thought it was kidney oat, if I thought it was kidney oat, I'd say you can only use it when you nullify it as less than the majority of a something, put a little crumble in a soup or something. But I don't think that that we have any concerns even about it being kidney oat. So to be cautious, we might recommend that the product only be consumed if it's purchased before Pesach, because then if there's any trace chametz whatsoever, then it falls onto, we go back to this list, these two pages. If you purchase it before Passover, it doesn't require a heksher because we've done the research. I've done the research into what comprises that product. And the product is also certified gluten-free and the company itself has confirmed that there's no grain content that is used. Did I explain it well enough? Whether or not you buy into it, what questions remain? Did I explain it well enough? What are your thoughts? Esther gets to go first. Again, we'll have you unmute. Yeah.
One of the questions I have is, you talked about this particular brand of the meat. There are other brands that don't have soy in it or other names on them. Are they all okay to eat for Passover, or are you just this particular brand?
I have only done the research on Impossible meat, ground meat. I think that it would be possible. I'm putting out there that for somebody who does eat kidney oat, I think it would be pretty reasonable to assume that they could eat Beyond Meat because they have a pretty similar list of minimal ingredients with limited filler or preservatives. So there's not a lot to be concerned with, but because of the way that pea protein, like PEA protein, is contained in is the main ingredient in Beyond Meat, it's more difficult to argue the same thing that I argue here with the soy protein concentrate, right? It probably is, I'm not sure, but it probably is kidney oat still.
Well, this doesn't have kidney oat in it anyway. So the only thing that I was asking is just if there's another brand, and you discussed soy in great detail, but if it doesn't have any soy, it's not an issue. It's not kidney oat to begin with.
Right. So. The difference, Esther, is that in Impossible Meat, they take soy flour what their main ingredient, soy protein concentrate, is soy flour that has been utterly transformed into this thing called soy protein concentrate that we can't even consider kit, you know, let alone chametz. But in Beyond Meat, their main ingredient, for example, is pea protein. It's a modified pea protein. And the pea, which is the same category as soy, but pea protein is not modified into unrecognizable territory in the way that the soy protein concentrate is.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. And it probably deserves more recognition because I'm not here shilling for Impossible Meat.
I know that. That's a non-issue.
But they should be. I'd love to be sponsored by them. Did anyone else have some questions or thoughts about what this means? While you were thinking about it, I'm so glad that you're interested, Marcy. Thanks for sticking around. Did I explain the yeast extract thing? Did you get it? The yeast extract they've confirmed it doesn't come from cereal. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
That was my number one concern too.
And because it's gluten-free, I like that I almost in a cynical way think the lawyers wrote that so that they wouldn't get sued, you know.
It's true. The one thing that we have to be careful about is that nowadays so many products are being made gluten-free but are still chametz. Like Honey Nut Cheerios are gluten-free and Cheerios are gluten-free, but that's still chametz. So it still doesn't guarantee things. That said, it's a great start. If you have a product that's gluten-free, that's the place to start with it, because then chances are that they're at least careful with their grains and maybe they even don't have grains of concern. So I'm really glad you stuck around. Thanks for asking the question that you did. And what I want to share with you, a closing thought that I absolutely stole from Rabbi Klickfeld, and I apologize in advance if you've heard me teach it on Rabbi Klickfeld's behalf or if you heard him teach it. But Esther, do you want to say something first?
No, it was just another product. That's fine. Not. Go ahead.
If you have questions about other products, I 100% welcome anybody sending me emails to ask about.
I was just going to add, because some people drink herbal tea. I know you can buy coffee that's never been opened and it doesn't have anything else. But on herbal teas, are they okay?
If you buy loose leaf black, white, or green tea, like if you buy from...
It has to be loose leaf.
The loose leaf. I think that you either need the loose leaf, you can buy that before Passover, or you can buy a hectored product. Because there are... Fewer, though. You're right. It's harder to find like chamomile tea for Passover. But I'm glad you asked that. So send me any questions you have. I'm going to tell you a story that Rabbi Klickfeld told over a summer, maybe 8 or 9 years ago. It was one of those summer combined services when Beitenu and Shir Chadash were together. And he told a story about a congregant here at Beth Am. And he said, I had a congregant make a meeting with me a week before Passover. The congregant makes a meeting with me and says, Rabbi, next week during Passover, I need to be in Chicago for a bunch of meetings. I think this person's a lawyer, a professional of some kind. I have to go. My clients require me to be at meetings after the Seders. I have to fly there. I'm going to Chicago. I'm staying for Chol Moed. I'm going to be there for some meetings in the middle of the holiday. I know that I have to meet up with them at a bar, at least at one point, like at a bar, at a restaurant. We're going to have a meeting with clients. What am I permitted to eat or drink there? Is the answer nothing? Is a glass of water okay? Can I have a cup of coffee or tea? Is there anything I can have, like fruit, a salad, something like that, that would be of no concern? What am I allowed to do? And Rabbi Klickfeld's response was the following. He said that with that one question that his congregant demonstrated to Rabbi Klickfeld, that congregant was thinking 100 times more about Passover during Passover than Rabbi Klickfeld had thought about it in a very long time. Because the way that his family did it was 2 weeks before Passover already, the whole house is turned over. Every product has a heksher in his home. I don't know that that's still the case, but that was at the time the case. Every product had a heksher. All the plates were plates only used for Passover, pots only used for Passover. And once he was in Passover and only eating in his home, he didn't have to think even for a second about Passover and the rules of eating on Passover, because he turned his home into an oasis of kosher for Passover food and eating. And he said, that's not necessarily the most admirable version of the thing, because we aren't meant to live in a paradise where it's so good that we've stopped thinking about it and stopped really engaging with these rules. So what I hope you get out of this, even if you're not interested in impossible meat, even if you hear all this and say, yeah, but in my house, whatever the case might be, I hope that this unlocks for you the thing that was unlocked in that conversation for Rabbi Klickfeld so long ago, and that I'm reminded of very frequently, that the whole point of it is not to learn once upon a time when you're young what is chametz and what is kitniot, and for the rest of your life only go to the store and buy things that someone else put a stamp on as kosher, but rather to keep relearning, re-examining, call the companies, call your rabbi and tell your rabbi to call the companies, figure out what more access might be available, because that's chirut, that's freedom on Passover. That's truly the intention of engaging with the world around us. So that's the intention that I put out there and on this. I hope you find, whether you're here with me live on Zoom or if you're listening to this as a podcast, I hope what's interesting to you about this is the permission and even the encouragement from me that you should go and you should ask questions and figure out what's possible so that you can live in the world. Just by asking those questions, you are observing Pesach even more.
What was possible for him to eat at that meeting?
I didn't ask what the answer was, but the answer is not nothing.
What's your answer?
You can have a glass of water for certain. There's more to it, but you can definitely have a glass of water. There's no concern about the glass of water. Nobody thinks that you're drinking chametz there. There's a difference, though, and this is for another class, about the difference between what is actually permissible and the things that we do or don't do in public because of the appearance of impermissibility. Is it permissible for me when I'm on a road trip to Palm Springs, I do this every time, can I go into a McDonald's to get black unsweetened iced tea from their you know, fountain, their like soda fountain? Can I go in there, take a soda fountain cup, you know, pay for it, obviously, pay for a soda fountain cup, fill it up with iced tea, put in my sweetener, head to my car and drive the rest of the way to Palm Springs? Totally. Do I do that with a kippah on my head? No.
No.
Right? I put a hat on. And so, Renee, the conversation is a yes and a yes but, right? It's a yes, you can totally have a glass of water. Wear a hat, right? Like, don't cause confusion to other Jews or to other people that you might, you know, that it might not be. But I still wouldn't have concern with a glass of water. I just want to name that there is a something else out there when it comes to Marit Ayin, the appearance of your behavior out in public. That also matters.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.